welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unforgiving 60. We're into our first proper episode, and we're joined by Dan Pronk, a doctor, Special Forces combat veteran, serial entrepreneur, and author, who also happens to be my baby brother. Dan, welcome.
Yeah, cheers, guys. Excellent to be here.
Now, congratulations on the release of your ebook, Average 70 Kilogram Dickhead. Now, despite...
It's a great title.
It's appropriately titled.
And I'm going to dig into each of those points in a second, but despite knowing most of the story, I reckon it's a great read. What was the inspiration behind writing it, mate?
Yeah, so I guess the emphasis behind it, I mean, that title there is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, and it's explained in the first chapter of the book, comes from a conversation that I had with a mate in my early 20s. But the theme is captured there, and it's basically the whole ethos of the book is just looking at how people with the regular skill set of your average 70-kilo dickhead can actually achieve exceptional things, as a lot of exceptional people do just have that average skill set, but through a very deliberate goal setting, well-defined goals, breaking the goals down into manageable chunks, and then persistently chipping away at those sub-goals until they add up to the overall objective. So that the book covers general themes of motivation, dealing with failure, goal setting, an ongoing evolution throughout life, so not stagnating, don't get bogged down, keep moving forward, touches on a bit of post-traumatic growth, and appreciating what you've had, making the most of opportunities, and they're the general themes.
So for those who aren't as familiar with your life story as I am, or perhaps who haven't paid the $5 to download your ebook, could you give us a bit of background on yourself in terms of how you got to where you are at the moment?
So in a nutshell, just grew up an average 70-kilo dickhead, just average at school, average marks, not particularly good at anything throughout my childhood. Graduated high school sort of mid-class, and at that stage was hell-bent on becoming a professional triathlete. Chased that dream for about 5 years, and then it became obvious that I was not going to be the athlete I wanted to be.
Or that you thought you were.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, it became evident that I wasn't as good as I had hoped. And then hit a bit of a crossroads and ended up almost falling backwards into medical school and the military. And those two came together. I completed medical schooling on an Army scholarship, then went into the Army system, had the opportunity to do the SAS selection course and got through that, which led to the remainder of my career working with special operations in a time when Afghanistan was in high rotation. So spent a bit of time there. And then following my discharge from the Army, went back into civilian medical practice in emergency department setting, started doing a Master of Business Administration, and those two things then came together in a medical management role that I currently do. And then on the side, I've managed to engage in a couple of business pursuits and a couple of extracurricular medical activities that relate back to the tactical medical piece that was a big part of my military medical time.
So when you read that CV, you know, there's a lot in it, and obviously you don't just get there overnight. You spoke a little earlier about breaking things into manageable chunks. I mean, how did you work that goal-setting process to get to where you are?
I think initially it was something I didn't do consciously. I knew when I got out of school that I wanted to be a triathlete, but I don't recall ever setting good, smart goals. In effect, I just charged headlong at it and sort of loosely knew where I wanted to go, had an idea of that, and did my best to get there. And probably with hindsight, I could have structured that much better and maybe could have done better for myself. However, when that all fell apart and then got the opportunity to go and study medicine, join the Army, and then through yourself, Ben, had my eyes open to what special operations looked like. That was the first time where I really thought, hey, I'm going to set this structured goal to be a member of special operations. I was already on a trajectory to become a doctor. And so that was where I first set a proper smart goal and then just chipped away at the improving myself towards SAS selection. And that meant breaking down what is a almost insurmountable task when you look at it in its entirety, but I had a long time to do it, and I looked at the various individual components that might make me more appealing to that environment or more capable of what I knew of the selection course. And so that led to a very structured sub-goal setting process that ultimately led up to the goal of going and doing the course and moving in that direction.
Can you give us some examples of what were the sub-goals you set yourself?
Well, from the outset, so the context was that was at the end of 2001, and I was at the end of my first year of medical school. So I knew that I had at least there was 3 more years of med school, 2 years as a junior doctor, a couple of years in the army before I'd even be able to try and get on the course. So I had 6-7 years to work with. And so I looked at what I perceived and what I knew from research as to what the attributes of a special operations soldier were, what might make me more appealing. The physical fitness side of things was obviously a big part of it, which I already had a background in with my triathlon, but this was very different. This was more pack marching, more focused on that functional strength, lots of chin-ups, lots of push-ups, these sort of things. So I started very slowly and deliberately building up my mileage to strengthen my body to carry loads. I enrolled in night school and studied Arabic for 3 years, which turned out to be absolutely useless to me because I never went to any Arabic-speaking countries. But it was the process and the discipline was very useful. And I think just that the use of that sort of cognitive muscle to learn a non-Latin-based language was fantastic. I did a lot of rock climbing, scuba diving. Once again, never had any utility in the military context, but it was all part of the discipline of trying to improve myself and reinforcing within myself this determination towards that goal, so that by the time I ended up on that course 6-7 years later, I was so convinced that I was capable of it and so invested in the goal that there was no way I was going to quit and withdraw myself, and barring a decent injury or being removed from the course, then I was fairly determined to get through.
It was actually quite funny. I was instructing on that course and obviously we were separated. I didn't have any direct dealings with you. But I remember in one PT, physical training session, seeing everyone struggling, and there were some pretty big boys on that course. And the title of your book was pretty apt. I looked over and saw an average 70-kilo dickhead there, and it was you. But you got through in the end.
Dan, by their very nature, goals have significant challenges. Now, as you pricey up your CV, it's clear that you will have confronted many challenges, from trying to be a professional triathlete to medical school to SAS selection to service on operations on the battlefield to your MBA to being an entrepreneur. What are some of the most significant challenges that you've faced?
I think the most significant by far was my transition out of the military, and that with hindsight, so I'm about 5 years out now, and as I got into that role in the army and then established myself in that role, with hindsight, I very much adopted that persona, and my work and me were so intimately linked that when I unplugged from that environment, what I found was that I'd sort of completely lost my self-worth. I found myself back in the civilian world and just struggling, and I still identified as a special operations doctor, but I'd been unplugged from that. I'd moved into state. I was trying to reestablish myself in a new role. At that initial time out of the army, I was doing fly-in, fly-out stuff at a mine site, which was, for me, quite unstimulating, wasn't rewarding. I didn't feel it was meaningful, and so I was a bit directionless. And so that was a real challenge. The study side of it, the MBA, was great, gave me a focus, but it didn't replace all the stimulus of the previous environment. And what I ended up sort of fumbling through, really, it wasn't that deliberate, but I ended up in an emergency department role. A good mate of mine gave me an opportunity to go and work for him in a busy ED, which brought back the professional satisfaction and professional stimulus, but also allowed me to be in an environment where I was challenged, where I felt like I was growing professionally. And then from a business side, I had engaged with another couple of mates of mine, had started a business called TACMED Australia, started by one bloke, and then 2 more of us bought in, and so that gave me an additional stimulus, and cumulatively this all started to add up for me to be able to set new ambitious goals to move towards. And so there was a real loss of direction there, and I think that's probably been the most challenging period of my life. And I had a similar thing when the triathlon dream fell through. But at that stage, I was in my early 20s and had a lot of other opportunities. And I hadn't invested as much in that as I had in my career with the Army. So there's been a couple of really challenging steps there. And that recalibration to a civilian environment and then resetting brand new goals completely unrelated to the previous ones to be able to feel that I'm moving towards something was very challenging.
I find that fascinating that disengaging from the SAS in the military was more challenging than giving medical care on the battlefield under fire.
Yeah, look, I think so. And I guess that is a testament to the amount of training that we received and the amount of investment by incredible mentors and instructors that I was privileged to have in that military medical capability, so that by the time I found myself in the pre-hospital environment dealing with blast gunshot wounds, I was almost on autopilot. I was operating in that level of, we'd done so much reality-based training, we'd programmed so much muscle memory that it was almost on autopilot, that kind of unconscious competence. And so I never felt particularly stressed at those times. And I think, as I said, that's nothing to do specifically with me. It's to do with the system and the personalities within that system that invested in me and empowered me to have that skill set to respond under duress. So, yeah, it was really well structured and very protective psychologically as well, to be able to feel like you're and actually do the job you're trained to do in some of the worst possible conditions.
How many operational tours did you do in uniform?
I did 5 in the end, 1 to Timor and 4 to Afghanistan.
And I think, having read a little bit about you and certainly listened to a lot of material, and of course we've met in person, I kind of want to unpack the battlefield experience in Afghanistan, where your principal responsibility was for sustaining life, and you had a range of people, particularly of course those that were wounded, that were reliant upon you. But we know the battlefield's very complex. It's incredibly challenging in itself. And loss is a part of, or one right-hand part of that challenge. When things didn't go right because of battlefield complexity, and when you did lose someone, how did you deal with that loss?
I think a lot of this, and this breaks down into different stages depending on the timing. You know, there's that immediate incident where you have the loss in the field, and that's the response coming back a step from that. So you've had an incident, you've had a critically injured soldier, and you're responding in that often tactical environment that's still fairly dynamic. And then you go into that autopilot, you go through your drills, you go through your processes, do your interventions. And if it deteriorates to the point, which sadly I found myself in on a couple of occasions, where you get beaten by the injuries and your casualty is unsalvageable and dies then and there, there's you need to then have the discipline at the time to switch from that life-saving, trying desperately to do your interventions, to a more of a logistical type move. And there was no role for emotion there. That's not the time to process these events, because there's still, oftentimes there was other casualties involved that you had to turn your attention to. There was always the tactical situation, but then you had this additional logistical situation where you needed to package up everything, make sure that you are packaging up that soldier, all their mission essential items, make sure you're not leaving anything behind, and then get them back somehow. So oftentimes withdraw back to your main body, organise a aeromedical evacuation for your casualties, work out logistically how you're going to get that dead team member back. And then from there, once you've extracted, you've got all the processes of the handing that body over to the appropriate authorities, documenting everything from a medico-legal perspective. So there's a lot of discipline in that really initial incident that you just fall back on. That once again comes back to your training. And then you have to start to work out how you're going to process all of this psychologically. And I think this comes down, particularly from a leadership perspective, to a huge amount of emotional intelligence. And that initial post after action review, if you like, is critical to get right. It's human nature to dwell on the what ifs, to question your actions, to run it over in your mind. Sadly, some people feel the need to point fingers and assign blame, which is counterproductive, particularly in that initial instance. So the leadership team comes in and is crucial in managing that. And we were very well supported. We had a lot of psychological support and also the environment, as you guys both well know, being former SAS officers, that you're very insulated because you're surrounded by like-minded people that understand what you're going through. You're surrounded by the people who've experienced the same thing with you. So that's a very therapeutic environment at that stage. Then, the show goes on operations, so you'll often find yourself back on the job. And so I guess I think it's quite healthy to push all that initial incident into the back of your mind, get on with your job, don't dwell on it. But at some point, you need to revisit it and do a proper debrief when a bit of time's passed and have a good look at the incident, at what happened, what the injuries were. Often by that time, you'll have access to potentially the X-rays, the post-mortem, these sort of things. So you will know what the cause of death was, what the injuries were. And that gives you an opportunity to objectively look at what killed the person, what interventions you did. And it unfortunately opens the possibility that something you did was inappropriate or you have missed something. But it's essential to do that to know how you can improve next time. So it's tough. It breaks down into phases, but managed correctly, it can be an overwhelmingly positive experience for individuals to help psychologically in the long term, but also to identify systemic or training deficits that have led to a problem that you can fix and have a better outcome next time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Now, you've spoken a lot, and particularly in that last conversation, about the professional response to these kind of traumas. But obviously there's a personal one as well, and at some stage you're going to end up back home with your thoughts. Now, I understand that Average 70 Kilo Dickhead isn't your first book. I've actually read the manuscript you wrote last time. Can you tell us a bit about that and the process of writing that first piece of work?
Yeah, so that manuscript you allude to is not gone to print by any stretch, but that stemmed from I'd gotten home from one particular tour, my second tour of Afghanistan, where we'd had a loss of three soldiers in pretty quick succession over about a six-week period in separate incidents. We lost three guys, all of which I was on the ground for and had responded to and couldn't salvage. And I'd gone through the remainder of that tour pushing all that to the back of my mind because I needed to keep functioning. I needed to keep doing my job, and there was no benefit in trying to process all that emotional baggage at that time. And when I got back to Australia in my debrief, my mandatory psychological debrief, I was talking about these events, and the psychologist, who is a brilliant woman, suggested that I write some of these events down in order to just get it down on paper, get it all sequential in as much detail as I could to try and just get it straight, process it a little bit. And I started doing that, and I found that to be a very cathartic exercise, capturing that. I found it to be a really mentally challenging and stimulating exercise, which helped. It meant that I wasn't just sitting around sort of dwelling on things. I actually had a purpose, and then that led to sitting down over a period of what was about 18 months, 2 years, and writing a 130,000 word book, basically, that just sort of documented a little bit pre-army, but mostly my time with special operations, and then just a little bit in that immediate discharge period from the army. And so that was that manuscript there, which, because of the very nature of it, it wasn't ever initially designed for publication. It contains detail that's inappropriate. It would need a fairly significant edit to get out there. But from a cathartic perspective, it was a fantastic exercise.
And we've spoken a lot about this concept of post-traumatic growth, which you alluded to before. Was that a bit of a kickstart to the growth you've obviously experienced since those traumatic events?
Yeah, look, I think it was. It was certainly a significant component to it, and it's an interesting beast, post-traumatic growth, and I think one that's worth talking about in these sort of forums, because I think it's something that people don't know about. There's a lot of dialogue out there, of course, about post-traumatic stress disorder, and there should be, but I fear that goes over the top, and that there's some people that the general public might have this misconception that every combat veteran is damaged, and that if you've experienced trauma, you will get post-traumatic stress disorder, and which is just simply not true. So that certainly but this concept of post-traumatic growth, which with hindsight I realize now I've experienced, is one where you have some bad events, you sustain some trauma, and then you go through a degree of post-traumatic stress, not necessarily deteriorating into the disorder where it's a recurrent sort of cyclic process, but you do deal with that post-traumatic stress and then you recover from that, which most people do. And that's another important thing to get out there. Yeah. People who experience post-traumatic stress and even PTSD, the recovery rate is excellent. It's multifactorial. Mm. There's a bunch of different components that add up to whether you're going to do well or poorly after it. But not only do most people recover from post-traumatic stress, a percentage of them will then go on to experience this post-traumatic growth. And it's like the old saying, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. And so it's characterized by people who often will rise to a higher level of function post-trauma, greater appreciation, new perspective on life, change of priorities. They don't get bogged down in the fine print. Greater appreciation of family and friends, increased feeling of purpose, all of these sort of things. And it's like a recalibration. You've all of a sudden seen how terrible things can be. And so going back to your mundane, normal life, you actually realize, hey, hang on, this is excellent.
Life's pretty good.
Yeah, life's pretty good. Yeah, so no, it's...
Dan, post-traumatic stress. If someone thinks they have it, what are the few things that they can do to deal with it or overcome it? Because it sounds from your explanation that it's curable.
Well, look, yeah, I mean, it's... Like I said earlier, Tim, there's a lot of variables, and going way back to the individual makeup of the person, their inherent resilience, then to their training. So, I mean, you can take a very resilient person, put them in a environment they're just not trained for, and then they'll experience a bunch of stress and potentially trauma. So, I mean, there's all those components. There's the actual event. You can, as you blokes both know, you can line up 10 people, expose them to the same event. Some will do well, some will be a bit bothered, some will be in a heap. And so there's all those factors, and then post, there's a lot of factors in terms of your social support, whether you're physically injured from the event or not physically injured, whether you've got something else to go to that's constructive and you feel that you're making a difference in terms of your professional satisfaction and what have you. But I think the key thing is to acknowledge it for a start, recognize the symptoms, and then talk about it. Like, everyone's different. There is no one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter approach to solving PTSD, unfortunately. However, I think the thing we know is not the right thing to do is bottling it up and trying to put on that macho persona and act like you're not affected by things. And sadly, we all know people who unfortunately have ended up taking their own lives on account of that. And at the funeral, everyone's saying, hey, I didn't even know he was struggling. So I think getting it out there is the first thing. I'm a strong believer in keeping yourself very busy, throwing yourself into a new task, a new ambitious goal. I think having a focus in life is key. I think that if you've fallen in a bit of a heap and you have too much time to sit around and dwell on it, and I certainly accept there's some people that are debilitated by mental illness from post-traumatic stress disorder and they're simply not in a mental state to do it. But I'm talking about the milder cases where if they can throw themselves into something new, something that occupies their mind, something that they feel is worthy, and start generating a bit of self-esteem, self-worth, and building themself up again in a new endeavour, I think that's very therapeutic.
Yeah. Now, switching tack, given you're my younger brother and have outshone me in pretty much every field of endeavour, I want to talk a bit more about your failures. You spoke before about knowing when to quit, and we've spoken separately about these ideas of grit, which was popularised by Angela Duckworth, but, you know, these wonderful motivational posters that say we should never, ever quit. But obviously, if you're flogging a dead horse, you need to know when it's time to stop. How did you know it was time to stop your triathlon, apart from the fact that you sucked?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was exactly how I knew it. Just took me 5 years to realize it. Unfortunately, it was a harsh realization for a young man. But it's a great point.
So you took less time completing a medical degree than you took in realizing you sucked at triathlon.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Thanks for pointing that out, Tim. Yeah, I got smarter as I got older there, mate. But it's a good point. I mean, there's all these sort of, you know, memes on the internet and motivational posters saying never quit and success is just around the corner and all that sort of stuff. And I think certainly you don't want to quit too soon. However, you need to know when to quit. So it's not about not ever quitting, but just knowing when to quit. And look, it's a good example with my goal as a triathlete. And when you look at that from a SMART goal perspective, so when I was 18 years old, showing a little bit of promise as a junior athlete, that goal to me was still realistic and attainable. I had what I thought was the potential. But then as I went through the years and fast forward 5 years from there, I found myself 23 years old, not really having gotten to anywhere near the level I wanted to be. I was training and racing with some of the best athletes in the world and nowhere near them. I was not even close to their level of performance. But the thing that really drove home the realization for me was there was a junior generation of athletes coming through that were 18, 19 year olds that were starting to beat me. And that was when I knew that what I wanted to achieve was no longer realistic or achievable. And so I was faced with the opportunity to compromise and keep going along my path and just keep trying to thrash it out as a sort of semi-pro triathlete, but not hitting the levels that I wanted to. So I could compromise and settle for something that wasn't my goal, or quit and refocus. And actually, I just listened to a great audiobook by Seth Godin called The Dip that talks exactly about this. It talks about when you start something, it's all exciting and new and you're motivated and it's great. And then you go through this period, this dip, as he describes it, where it's drudgery and you're doing the hard yards. And that's where a lot of people will quit. But he's sort of talking about sticking that out and then ultimately you'll hit that success. However, he puts the caveat on that if you obviously find yourself in what he describes as a cul-de-sac, like a dead end, if it's obvious that what you want to achieve is not going to be possible, he says quit fast. And so just stop, refocus, and then move on to something that is achievable. And so I guess that's from a triathlon perspective. I came to that realization age 23. I quit at that. And then that gave me the opportunity to recalibrate to pursue the medical stuff, the military stuff, neither of which I was particularly passionate about at the start. But then as I went along those pathways, I got my eyes open to special operations, and all of a sudden I was hugely passionate, and that just supercharged my motivation. So I think it's not about never quitting, but just knowing when to quit.
Dan, what battlefield medical skill would translate to everyday life that would be relevant for ordinary people?
So one I'm hugely passionate about here, and in the last couple of years, a group of highly motivated individuals that I've managed to tag onto have started a body called the Australian Tactical Medical Association, ATMA, which I'm lucky enough to have a seat on the board of. And this plays into this construct, and it's basically looking at lessons learned on the battlefield. And historically, wars are great opportunities to advance medical equipment. Sadly, you're getting your casualties and that forces your medical developments. And the contemporary conflicts, Afghanistan, Iraq, are no different. But the one piece of kit, to come back to your question, that I think is fantastic and very pleasing to see moving into civilian first response here in Australia is arterial tourniquets. And so this is a device that's designed to cut off the blood flow to a massively bleeding limb. And so we know beyond question that the leading cause of preventable death on the battlefield is bleeding out from what's called a compressible bleed. So something you could potentially stop if you got to it in time, had the right kit and knew how to use it. And so if you've got big bleeds in legs or arms, as we saw with the IED strikes, sadly, soldiers getting their legs blown off, those bleeds, soldiers bleed to death within 5-6 minutes from those arterial bleeds. And so that led to the development of these arterial tourniquets. That's a tourniquet loops around the bleeding limb up above the bleed and tightens up to a point where you cut off the blood flow to the limb so it can no longer bleed. Very simple, very cheap piece of kit that used effectively and quickly is life-saving in a casualty that would otherwise die. Now, that's been proven beyond doubt in the military environment that these are life-saving. They've saved thousands of lives. Afghanistan and Iraq, but it was slow to be adopted in civilian pre-hospital first response. And the thing that really drove it in the international context was terrorist events such as the Boston bombings in the States, the mass school shootings, the multi-site terrorist attacks around Paris in France, and the list goes on, sadly. And slowly the international community started to really embrace these military pre-hospital bits of kit, including arterial tourniquets. Australia's been a step behind that again, and lucky we've been somewhat insulated from those events in Australia for a variety of reasons that hasn't forced us to adopt these techniques, but that they are starting to come in. And pleasingly, the Australian Resuscitation Council has just in the last couple of years added arterial tourniquets into their massive hemorrhage control protocols, massive bleeding control. And so these devices are available commercially. You can hop online and buy them. Company I co-own, TACMED Australia, proprietary limited, there's a bit of a plug there, sells these things online, and there's also an e-book that TACMED's got available for free. Downloaded off the ebook to learn off the internet to learn to use these things. But it's a bit of kit you can buy for $30-$40. If you've got a car medical kit, that's the best place to have it. Or if you go camping, fishing, hunting, anywhere where you might come across, be first on scene to a decent trauma. And motor vehicle accidents, a great example. These aren't just for the gunshot wounds or the blast injuries. And in February this year, actually, we saw a great example of a tourniquet, arterial tourniquet being used. A police officer in New South Wales was setting up a RBT, and a distracted driver drove into him and severed one of his legs. And this guy, fortunately, one of the first responders was another police officer, had an arterial tourniquet, applied it and saved his life. And so it's just a great example of these devices that have been intended initially and developed for military applications being equally as useful in a fairly benign civilian context with the same life-saving outcome. So I'd encourage anyone listening to get themselves an arterial tourniquet, learn how to use it. If you want to download the ebook off the TACMED Australia website, have a look at that. That'll give you a good start on learning how to use it, and chuck it in the car, because if you're first on scene, you've got 4 or 5 minutes if someone's bleeding significantly from an amputated limb, and a simple intervention with a simple, cheap bit of kit could be the difference between life and death there.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So that Lodi's given us a 2-minute warning, and I wanted to ask my final two questions that relate to the title of our podcast, Unforgiving 60, which is drawn from a Rudyard Kipling poem called If. And the first question I actually want to ask to both of you, because that poem has a great significance to you both, and sadly, nearly 12 months ago, I think you lost your father. Could you perhaps talk about how he used the poem to inspire you?
Look, I think there's been a few key poems and passages in both of our lives, and certainly If by Kipling is right up there with them. I mean, the Man in the Arena by Roosevelt is another one. It's not the critic who counts, sometimes referred to, and then Desiderata by Max Ehrman. But these were all things that Dad was introduced us to from a very early age and exposed us to and would recite to us on occasion. And it was just, I guess, as kids, with it probably not much of it sunk in, but then over the years you revisit them and you take little pieces more out of it. But, yeah, so I think, and I talk to it in my book about the influence that Dad had on me in terms of nature and nurture, and just such a positive individual with these great sort of morals and ethics that he imparted on us, but then also introducing us to these sort of magnificent pieces of poetry from the likes of Kipling. It has had an enduring effect.
I always, he used to recite the if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch. I like that line, the idea that you want to be able to mix it with the best of them, but not to think that you're any better than any other person in the street.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for sharing, and I know he's very proud of you both. And Dan, in your book, The Average 70-Kilo Dickhead, you actually use a line from Kipling's poem, which is, "If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too." How do you explain that?
Well, the way that talks to me, and the context I use that in, is with regards to criticism, and so it comes after I've drawn reference to Roosevelt's line, "It is not the critic who counts," which pretty much says, hey, don't listen to the critics, just knuckle down. You know, the man in the arena, he's the guy that counts, the guy who's sort of, you know, faces mud with blood and sweat and dust and errs and comes up short, you know, to palm. But so the in that, it's pretty much just shut the critics out and don't listen to them, set your goal and go towards it, don't let anyone deter you. And I think a lot like quitting, there's a time to quit. As we discussed earlier, I also think there is a role for criticism. And I look at that line from Kipling, where he talks about make allowance for their doubting too, is it's a bit more inclusive. So it allows you to listen to what the critic's saying. So they're doubting you. They're saying, no, that can't be done. And if you listen to that and think, well, why are they saying that? Take it on board. And then you can do one of two things with it. You might sort of realise, oh, hang on a sec, he's right, I need to adjust my plan, or I hadn't thought of that. So I think it's rather than just completely shutting the critics out, if they are validated and if they are qualified people to give you criticism, then have a listen to it, take it on board. If you can use it, or you can always then just dismiss it anyway and go on how you were. But that's how I interpret that line from that poem. So it's not as completely exclusive as Roosevelt's passage. It's a bit more inclusive, but make allowance for it, but then have, you know, you trust yourself when they doubt you anyway. Believe in yourself, but at least have a listen to what they have to say.
Nice one, mate. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us. That was Dan Pronk, CV too long to list, but most recently the author of the ebook Average 70 Kilo Dickhead. Before we let you go, Dan, I just want to unpick that title for one quick second. I think we can all agree that based on our conversation, you're pretty average. I can certainly attest to the fact that you're a dickhead. But are you still weighing in at 70 kilos, mate? I reckon you've blown out.
Yeah, look, it has blown out a bit. I'm probably stretching the scales to 76. It just didn't have the same ring to it. And it also didn't fit with that initial conversation that where the title came from. So, yeah, I need to get back down to my fighting weight. Thanks for pointing that out there. We'll see how we go after Christmas.
Righto. Well,
there is one thing that Ben and I do have in common, and that is that both of our brothers are better blokes than us.
I appreciate that, Tim. Now, cheers for having me on. This has been fantastic. Great chatting with you guys.
No, I appreciate it. And listen, seeing as you have definitely lived a boring life, we're going to go out to the a song of the same title. This is The Externals, A Boring Life.
Nice.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence and would love your insights and feedback. Also, if you know someone who is living a life less ordinary, let us know. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's debrief@unforgiving60.com. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and rate us on iTunes. You can follow us on social media. Just search for Unforgiving60 on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Until next time, we wish you luck in filling your unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Noise breaks morning, thunder shoe his head, one man feels the pressure.